Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chip Verley, senior analyst with Political Research Associates, who examines the militant protests seen at healthcare reform town hall meetings and their connection to America's wider extreme right-wing movement. Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes, who talks about the fight ahead for union activists and their supporters to win congressional passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. And Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, who discusses the problems he sees with Attorney General Eric Holder's reported plan to launch a limited investigation into Bush administration torture policy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Iran's police chief, General Ismail Ahmadi Mogaddam, has publicly acknowledged pro-democracy protesters were tortured while in custody at the Khalrizak Detention Center in Tehran. The detention center was recently closed by an order of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. According to the Guardian newspaper, the head of the detention center and three policemen who beat dissidents are now in jail. Human rights groups say three activists died after they were tortured at the Khalrizak Detention Center. General Mogaddam denied any responsibility for the deaths. In late July, 140 dissidents were released and provided vivid reports of beatings, torture, and rape of prisoners. Three prominent dissidents died while in police custody. Included among the dead was Mohsen Ruhollahmini, the son of a prominent conservative and an advisor to presidential candidate Mohsen Rezaei. His family says he died of a heart attack and bleeding in his lungs. Islamic authorities in Iran conducted a show trial of 100 opposition figures, saying they attempted to overthrow the government. Among those accused was Iranian citizen Hossein Rassam, a political analyst at the British Embassy in Tehran. The British government protested the proceedings. The Nation magazine reports a former Blackwater manager and a former security contractor have made serious charges against Blackwater founder Eric Prince in depositions filed in federal court in Virginia. The sworn affidavits, related to several civil lawsuits filed by Iraqi citizens, allege a number of crimes committed by Prince, a devout evangelical Christian who controls a series of companies that have been implicated in wrongdoing in Iraq. The two men, whose identities are protected by the court, claim Prince facilitated the murder of individuals cooperating with a federal investigation of Blackwater. Prince is also alleged to have used his private planes to ship illegal or unlawful weapons into Iraq. Blackwater has been under federal investigation since the September 16, 2007 shooting in Nisour Square in Baghdad that killed 17 Iraqi civilians. Five Blackwater guards are awaiting a criminal trial on manslaughter charges. A sixth guard pled guilty to manslaughter charges and is cooperating with prosecutors. Iraqi nationals have filed a number of civil suits against Blackwater, now known as XE Services, LLC. The cases are being handled in federal court by private attorney Susan Burke and the Center for Constitutional Rights. Despite various legal challenges to Blackwater, the company has received $174 million in U.S. security contracts in Iraq and Afghanistan from the Obama administration. These contracts were initiated under President Bush, but the State Department has continued to fund them. Progressive legislators like Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky have called for a total ban on contracts to Blackwater. The Los Angeles Times reports nearly 5 million of the most polluting cars, those built before 1984, have been barred from the popular Cash for Clunkers car rebate program. The exemption was successfully pushed by the Specialty Equipment Market Association, the trade group for companies selling services and parts to classic cars and antique car collectors. Thus, some of the worst gas guzzlers, like a 1981 Ford pickup, will remain on the road. The lobby for antique cars feared the clunkers program would damage the market for replacement parts. Trade groups for junkyards and service garages also opposed the clunker trade-in program because it would have required the destruction of the drivetrain on the clunkers turned in. Currently, cars over 25 years old make up only 2% of the national car market, but they generate a significant amount of air pollution. A 1965 Chevy Malibu, for example, produces 400 times the smog created by a 2009 Chevy Malibu, notes the California Air Resources Board. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
town hall meetings held by congresspersons and senators in their home districts over the summer recess have been a magnet for right-wing activists opposed to President Obama's plan to reform the failed U.S. healthcare system. Supported by Republican Party officials, conservative talk show hosts, and some sectors of the insurance and healthcare industry, protesters have made outrageously false claims that reform legislation will force the euthanasia of senior citizens, mandate abortions for handicapped fetuses, and abolish the nation's private insurance companies. Some activists have compared President Obama with Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Pol Pot, while others have attended recent presidential events carrying firearms and making both blatant and subtle calls for violent resistance to what they call creeping American socialism. The incendiary language and conspiracy theories that are helping drive the right-wing response to health care reform in 2009 share many of the same radical views that fueled the McCarthy era of the 1950s and the militia movement of the 1990s. With America's first African-American president in the White House, white supremacist and violent religious groups have increased their criminal activities and recruitment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chip Burleigh, senior analyst with Political Research Associates and author of the recent report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. He examines the militant protests seen at healthcare reform town hall meetings and their connection to America's wider extreme right-wing movement.
Well, it's very clear that you have a number of different forces, elite forces, that are sending out all kinds of alarmist messages to a very large audience that includes corporations and right-wing media and right-wing politicians and all sorts of demagogues who really want to oppose Obama on every possible level. I think they saw that Sotomayor was going to get seated at the Supreme Court, and so this was the next big opportunity. Healthcare is an issue that really pushes a lot of buttons with people, so I think that's part of it. Partly it's the collapsed economy for a lot of folks. Partly it's just a whole lot of white people have a lot of anxiety about a president who's a black man. I think it all sort of fits together. And so you have to draw a distinction between the fact that a lot of this information that's being sent out into the population is contrived and it is misinformation, from the fact that these are real people. These are neighbors. These are, in some cases, family members. They're angry. They're anxious. And they have every right to show up at a town meeting and ask tough questions. What they don't have a right to do is intentionally disrupt and stop other people from talking or asking questions or become a mob. And I think that that's the issue. And I'm not saying that, you know, militant protests should never be allowed. I've been part of them myself. But there's something very special about preventing an elected official from getting questions from an audience. And I think that's what's been happening. And it's been very scary for a lot of people to show up at these meetings and have folks absolutely over the top about claims that they're going to kill grandma and that since FDR built big government and big government is socialism and national socialism is Nazism, then Obama is Hitler. And you go, phew, whoa, wait a minute, stop. But it's scary to see democracy in the state that it's in. So I wear a couple hats. I wear a hat as a person who watches the right, saying right-wing populism is always dangerous. It almost always blames people of color or immigrants or other minorities or oppressed peoples with scapegoating and demonization and these apocalyptic claims. But wearing my I like democracy hat, I'm thinking the Democrats are doing a pretty lousy job of talking to people about policy, and as soon as somebody shouts boo, they run into the corner and say, okay, no single payer, no government option, what do you want us to do? So, I mean, that's pathetic. Both sides are pathetic.
There have been some instances where protesters have showed up with posters and rhetoric calling for violence in subtle and not so subtle ways. There was a man in New Hampshire wearing a sidearm when he came to a town hall meeting that President Obama spoke at. What is the potential for violence being sort of part of the environment here in the call to militant opposition against Barack Obama and his quote-unquote socialist agenda?
Well, again, right-wing populism is based on resentment and anxiety. It's often racist and anti-immigrant, and it often, if it continues to grow in a society, spins off violence. But let me point out that since Obama was elected, there have been 9 murders connected to white supremacist ideology, 9, including attacks on Jewish institutions, on people of color in Massachusetts, on immigrant family in the Southwest, police officers in Pittsburgh. It's really astonishing that people haven't woken up to the fact that the violence is already occurring.
If you were to advise those citizens and organizations that are in favor of health care reform, whether they be Democrats or grassroots activists, what would you tell them to do in order to counter the misinformation and the success of these town hall meeting protests that has certainly had a willing partner in the corporate media, which, you know, focuses on conflict with very little substance to counter the lies and the crude disinformation tactics?
Well, I think people need to find a backbone. It'd be nice if there was leadership from the Democratic Party, but apparently, you know, that isn't forthcoming. So everybody who supports fair health care and a revised health care system that really looks to the treatment of illness and then prevention of illness for all people in America, let's get up off our butts and do something. Let's show up at these remaining meetings. Let's call our elected officials. Let's talk to our neighbors, our coworkers. It's up to us to raise some hell. What's the matter with us? We're being out-organized by a handful of, you know, right-wing demagogues, and there are people in our towns and neighborhoods who are going off with this tremendous anxiety and anger, and we can play a role in standing up and saying, I know you're angry, you have a right to ask questions, but chill out. Stop disrupting the meeting. People have a right to participate, but they don't have a right to be a mob. Let's talk this over. Let's confront the bad information. It's rebut, rebuke, reaffirm, the three R's. You rebut the bad information, you rebuke the people who supplied the information, and then you reaffirm what you stand for. This is basic organizing. I don't know what the Democrats' playbook is, but it certainly isn't what kind of organizing that labor unions and the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the gay and lesbian rights movement did so well. I don't know why they've given up on organizing real people in real places.
That was Chip Erlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates and author of the report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. Contact PRA by calling area code 617-666-5300. Or visit their website at publiceye.org. In late July, Democrats in Congress signaled they may drop their support for a key provision of the Employee Free Choice Act, legislation the labor movement has said is its top priority. The provision in question, referred to as card check, would require an employer to recognize a union among its workers if a majority of them simply sign union cards, and would not require a secret ballot election now mandated under the National Labor Relations Act. While not ruling out a secret election, the legislation would simply shift the decision-making power about the union ballot process from the employer to the workers. Under current law, tens of thousands of employees are fired or discriminated against every year for supporting a union. An estimated 60 million Americans would like to join a union, but are unable to do so under the current system. The nation's major corporations, trade associations, and conservative groups have vowed to fight the Employee Free Choice Act and pledged to spend millions of dollars to defeat its passage in Congress. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes, a media and organizing project that publishes a monthly magazine. Since its founding in 1979, Labor Notes has been bringing together union activists, leaders, and rank-and-file members to strengthen the labor movement from the bottom up. Brenner explains where the Employee Free Choice Act now stands and how employers or their workers can benefit, depending on which provisions make it through the legislative process.
Right now in Congress, this is a real question mark for folks in the labor movement about whether or not the Employee Free Choice Act will actually strip out the provision to allow workers to sign up via majority cards or not. And I got to say, for folks like me who are really far from the halls of Congress, it's a real mystery what's happening up on Capitol Hill right now. All the signals that we are getting in the media are that key Democratic legislators have indicated that they're not willing to maintain the provision for majority sign-up via union cards, that they're going to force secret ballot elections, that they're going to sort of revert to the way that things are currently done. I actually think it really misses what's the key issue here in the debate about union organizing in the 21st century. The issue is not so much whether or not we have a secret ballot election or whether we sign up via card majority. The issue is really the unmitigated, you know, unfettered employer opposition to union organizing that's happening in this country right now. If you start talking about forming a union in your workplace, I guarantee you there will be a rain of terror that comes down on your head by your employer. That's just how it works in America today. There's over 10,000 people every year that are getting fired for forming unions or trying to form unions in this country, and there's virtually nothing that the law does to stop that.
So, Mark Brenner, aside from whether card check will be in or out of the final legislation, there are other provisions in the Employee Free Choice Act that could help level the playing field for workers. Things like increasing penalties on employers who violate the law, and I think also something about speeding up the process, because so often an employer can drag things out for so long that the union drive just dies. Can you describe some of these provisions?
A couple of things that the Employee Free Choice Act is trying to do to at least balance the playing field somewhat. The first part we've talked about, which is to implement a card check provision, which allows people to do majority sign-up. That would right away fix some of the imbalance. Second, it actually increases the fines that can be levied against violators, employers that violate the law, up to $20,000. It raises the fine level up to $20,000 per violation. That's a big increase, although, frankly, if you're a multi-million, if not multi-billion dollar corporation, that would still seem like chump change to keep a union out. So, you know, even upping the number doesn't necessarily create enough of a disincentive. It allocates triple back pay for workers who are fired. Right now, the way the law works is if you get fired for union activity and sometime 3 years down the line, the Department of Labor actually hears your case and all the appeals are settled and you get a favorable ruling that says, yes, in fact, you were fired for union activity, the company is obligated to give you back pay for all of those years that you were off the job, the 3 years that you were off the job in my example, minus any money that you've earned in the meantime. So if you get fired from a job and you go out and get another job, the company is not going to have to pay you virtually anything. So, of course, there's a tremendous incentive for any union employers to fire some of the strongest union supporters in any organizing campaign. This actually is going to triple the back pay requirements that companies will have to pay. So it will actually try to create more of a disincentive, financial disincentive, for companies to violate the law and to fire workers. The other thing, which is in some ways even more important, is that it would give the National Labor Relations Board the right to reinstate workers immediately who are believed to have been fired because of their support for the union. Right now, you get fired and you have to go through appeal and appeal and appeal, and you don't get reinstated until after all the appeals have been heard. This would actually almost presume that you were fired for union activity and have you reinstated immediately and level the playing field in that way, so that another way of trying to take out the intimidation factor that firing pro-union employees has. Another big problem that we have in America today when you try to form a union is that even if you win, even if you surpass all of these hurdles that I mentioned, and you actually succeed in getting your vote, companies are under no obligation to settle with you, to actually bargain in good faith, to try to reach an agreement. So many, many, many union workers organize, win a secret ballot election, and then never get a first contract because employers just refuse to bargain with them. And so the Employee Free Choice Act would have a 90-day window in which, if both sides cannot reach an agreement, federal mediator will be appointed, and there'll be mediation. If that doesn't work, then the case will be sent to binding arbitration, and then an arbitrator will actually reach a decision about what the first contract for the union will look like. Now, what actually will survive the legislative process? You know, your guess is as good as mine, but at least from our hope, from anybody who's pro-union in this country, it's that it's going to look something like the original bill and keep some of the key provisions, which are really trying to put a check on companies that are engaged in just an unmitigated, all-out assault on any worker in this country that wants to try to exercise their right to form a union.
That was Mark Brenner, Director of Labor Notes. For more information on the Employee Free Choice Act and other labor issues, call their office in Detroit at area code 313-842-6262 or visit the group's website at labornotes.com. www.freedomfighters.org. Responding to reports that President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder is considering opening a limited investigation of Bush administration torture policy, Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat of New York, warned President Obama not to pressure Mr. Holder against appointing a special prosecutor. The president has repeatedly said he wants to look forward and not backward with regard to Bush administration violations of U.S. and international law. According to the Los Angeles Times, Holder may soon initiate a criminal probe, but would limit its scope to CIA interrogators who went beyond guidelines established by Justice Department attorneys John Yoo and Jay Bybee in 2002 memos, authorizing waterboarding and other harsh interrogation methods. Human rights groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have criticized the initiation of a limited investigation, declaring that the prohibition against torture under U.S. and international law is absolute, with no one who authorized torture being above the law. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and an attorney specializing in human rights and the law of armed conflict. Horton discusses the reasons why a special prosecutor may have no choice but to expand an investigation to hold accountable Bush administration officials who authorized torture.
We've gotten a lot of reports in the press, including in the New York Times and Washington Post, saying that he wants only an extremely narrow investigation, that basically the special prosecutor will be told to take the torture memoranda as effective and only look at torture and abuse that occurred that was in excess of torture that was authorized by the torture memoranda. But in fact, if you look at the Department of Justice regulations on the appointment of special prosecutors, they say that the Attorney General is supposed to describe the operative facts of a crime, and then it's really up to the special prosecutor once appointed to investigate and follow leads and take the leads wherever they go. So that would suggest that this sort of blinding or limitation really is not appropriate. And indeed, I would think no matter what attempted limitation Holder attempts to put on it, I think a properly motivated, conscientious, independent prosecutor is going to follow the evidence where it takes him, and it's not going to be limited by these sorts of considerations. And the second point, who's it going to be? He has a list of 10 people, five inside the department, five outside. And the latest word I've heard is that it is most likely that John Durham, who is a senior prosecutor from Connecticut, is going to get this appointment. Durham, of course, was already picked by Michael Mukasey to look at the destruction of CIA torture tapes. So it looks like Holder's going to approach this just as an expansion of that existing assignment.
If the United States under Barack Obama fails to conduct a thorough investigation and prosecute those who are found guilty of breaking the law, either U.S. or international law, what are the options for nations outside the United States? We have a Spanish judge, Judge Garzon, who's had a history of prosecuting cases across international boundaries. Does the United States open itself up to a lot of intervention by countries outside of ours if Barack Obama does nothing?
That's exactly the problem that they're facing right now. And in fact, the Spanish, the Audiencia Nacional, which is the Spanish National Security Court, has opened a criminal investigation. In fact, they've been looking into the six Bush lawyers who were responsible for torture cases, and Judge Garzon is handling it. Actually, there's another judge who's also working on it. There are two judges in two separate cases working on this right now. And they've told the United States that, in fact, their proceedings would terminate or be suspended if the U.S. were to pick up an investigation. But I think that points to the problem, because torture is it's a special kind of crime under international law, because it's subject to a principle of universal jurisdiction. And that means that if the country with the most responsibility for it, in this case, it's certainly the United States, does not investigate, then any other country in the world is free to open a criminal investigation and go after those involved, including U.S. citizens, which is what the Spanish have done. I mean, the Spanish have acted because there were five Spanish citizens, or five Spanish subjects, of course, Spain's a kingdom, who were tortured in Guantanamo. And as a result of a ruling in the Spanish Supreme Court, a criminal investigation was opened into those cases.
Barack Obama apparently has made a political calculation that pursuing Bush administration law-breaking crimes, the wiretapping, torture, and all of the like, that it's not worth it to him. He is continually saying he wants to look forward and not backward. What's the flaw in that logic, in your view? Obviously, you don't think that's the right course of action. Where is Barack Obama wrong on that?
Well, yeah, it might be very wise politics. I don't doubt that. You know, we have David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, who are convinced that that this issue is going to get in the way of health care and other higher priority items. But that's not the way a criminal justice system is supposed to operate. That is, whether it's politically convenient or not politically convenient to investigate crimes. These are extremely serious crimes, and not investigating them, not acting on them, has consequences. Just to cite an example, if we look at the events that have occurred in Iran over the last 6 weeks, you know, we've had thousands of protesters who've been seized and held, many of them at Evin Prison, notorious institution in Tehran, and we now have multiple confirmed reports that waterboarding has been introduced in this prison. Now, why is that? The Iranians never before used waterboarding. Why suddenly are they using waterboarding? Because the U.S. administration introduced and used waterboarding, and we have people like Richard Cheney running around saying it's not torture, it's perfectly okay. So the failure to act on, the failure to prosecute by the United States is resulting in the spread of these torture techniques around the world. And if we're going to battle it, there's going to have to be consequences for those who brought torture onto the palette of permissible techniques for the United States.
That was Scott Horton, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and a lecturer at Columbia University Law School. Read Horton's No Comment blog online at harpers.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.